This is KMUW, Wichita Public Radio. Engage ICT Democracy on Tap is a community engagement event series of KMUW Wichita. The following event took place on May 9th at the Monarch in Wichita, Kansas. All right, let's get going. Welcome, everyone, to Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Really glad to see such a wonderful crowd here tonight, and we've got an excellent topic and some excellent panelists for you. First, though, we want to thank our partners and sponsors this evening. First and foremost, a big round of applause to the Monarch for providing us the venue as well as the snacks. Also, thanks go to the Wichita Public Library, which provide every month for us further reading resources, and we have them here for the topic tonight, as well as for all of the topics from past Engage ICT events. So if you missed a topic that you thought you might be kind of interested in, those are really good resources if you'd like to learn more about them. We also provide the audio from prior Democracy on Tap events at engageict.org, or you can find them at kmuw.org as well. So if you'd like to, you can just go back and listen to past events. So thank you to the library for those further reading resources. We appreciate their partnership. And finally, a big round of applause and thank you to VolunteerKansas.org for sponsoring Engage ICT this year. All right, we'll go ahead and jump in here. We have three panelists for you tonight, and each one will kind of give a little introduction of themselves. We'll start with Dr. Patricia Dooley, who is with the WSU School of Communication and the Sunflower Coalition. Welcome, Dr. Pat.
Well, can you hear me? Everybody hear me? Okay. It's just a real pleasure to be here to talk with you about something that I think is on a lot of people's minds. Is that ringing or something? Or is it okay? Is it okay? Okay. I've always been interested in integrity in government. But how do we know that our government officials and the offices that they work within are doing their jobs the way that we would hope they would be doing them? How can we know? We can only know if we have access to their activities, how they spend money, what they do in so many different ways. And so there is no First Amendment right to know, but there are laws that have been enacted by the federal and all of our state governments to give us our window, the window that we can look through, hopefully, eagerly and without fail. We will find our way to the right information. Now, I teach at Wichita State University and I at the Elliott School of Communication, and one of the classes I teach is called Communication Law and Responsibility, and it is my pleasure every semester to teach a unit on open government transparency and related matters. And one of the things that I think is so interesting is that we have laws on the books, and they're pretty clear. We have laws on the books, and that every time I send out a group of students to do an audit, and that what I mean by that is I figure out a bunch of records in various offices in town that should be available without a batting an eyelash. They're so routine. I never send my students out to identify and get access to anything that's controversial. Just really routine information and records. Every time I send my students out to make a request, there are violations of the law. they are refused access every single semester. So then I turn that information over to the Kansas Sunshine Coalition, and they exist to take care of any kind of problems that come their way. If they get a call, then they'll check into whatever it is the caller has a question about in terms of having a problem, person having a problem getting a record, or if a person has a problem with access or lack of access to a meeting that should be open to the public. But I think the shocking thing for the students in my classes is that it is always the case that there are violations of the law when they go ask for the most routine kind of records. This is a lesson for them. I'm not trying to say in any way, shape, or form that government workers and government officials are bad people. It's just a matter of knowing what the law is, being used to responding to the law in a way that is nuanced as... And I think there's, but I think that something happens to a person when they begin to work for a government office. Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers person, you all have heard of him, the famous U.S. Supreme Pentagon Paper Court decision. There's a documentary out recently, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, about his life and his work. And he talks about how when you have access to information that the average citizen does not have, it's very easy to become a different... You see the world in a different way. And you sort of pit yourself against the public. Not everybody, but some people actually do get a little bit carried away with that power that they have. He was mostly talking about people in the highest reaches of the top secret world, but I think that that is also true in our everyday ordinary offices right here in Wichita, that sometimes over time, somebody working in one of those offices begins to think of the public as we versus them. And that isn't the way it should work. So I'll just say that I'm glad to be here, and I'm more than happy to talk with anybody at any time about any of these matters. And so it's great to be here tonight.
Thank you very much. Our second panelist this evening is Seth Etter with Open Wichita and also the Open Gov Foundation. A big round of applause for Seth. Thank you.
So, as she said, my name is Seth Etter. My day job is I work for the Open Gov Foundation, and we are an organization that is... We consider ourselves a civic tech organization. The field of civic tech in general is...
Getting some feedback.
The field of civic tech in general is the idea of applying modern technology practices to government and politics, because, you know, anybody can see that the private sector clearly is using technology more effectively than any sort of public-facing government service. So when you go to pay your water bill, it's sometimes a painful experience, but you go to pay your Spotify bill and it is beautiful and amazing. So why is that? So much of our world is driven by technology these days, so the idea is we should use that to fix the thing that is running the majority of the world, which is our government and our government and political systems. So a major piece of the civic tech field is this idea of open data, and this ties straight into FOIA, freedom of information, and government transparency. The idea is all this information that they're collecting that is legally belongs to the public, that you can file a freedom of information request or a CORA request and receive the information, it should just be published proactively. There's no reason why, if it legally, you know, we have the right to access it, it should just be accessible. Right now, one of the big problems is that if there's some government information that you want to access, know, first of all, you pay taxes, so that's your information. You paid to produce that information, so you have the right to access it. But because the processes that exist in most governments aren't publishing this data proactively, you have to file a request. And then somebody has to manually produce that data and then deliver it back to you. And then they get to charge you for whatever it costs to produce that data. Sometimes that can be thousands of dollars. And if you're just the average citizen, that's not feasible. But, you know, again, that shouldn't be the way it is. If this is information that rightly belongs to you, you shouldn't have to pay for it. Now, again, one of the organization I run locally is Open Wichita. So we call ourselves a civic hacking group. And the idea is we are community, you know, we're just citizens, we're technologists, and we're trying to look for quick, targeted solutions that can improve local government or politics or anything, you know, that falls under the realm of a civic duty. And a big part of that is open data, because we can do things as volunteers that deliver value to the community if the government publishes their data proactively, and we can use that data to, you know, build tools, we can run analysis on it and figure out ways that, you know, different policy changes might be more effective. You know, the possibilities are endless, and at the end of the day, we just say, you know, you should put these processes in place so this data is available, and then transparency is just a given at that point. It's not we have to fight for it. We have to request this information. It should just be there. You know, the systems that are collecting the data are already technology-based. So, you know, it just takes a little bit of investment to create those procedures so the data is already available. So we advocate for the use of open data. One of our first projects was getting the city of Wichita to adopt an open data policy, which is, you know, the first piece of legislation that says we will start adopting open data practices. I will sing high praises for our city because they did that very willingly. You know, they were eager to tackle this and to look for community partners that they can go on this endeavor with. So, kudos to Wichita, because they're doing better than a lot of cities are. So. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Seth. Our third panelist this evening is Jean Hayes, who works at the Wichita Eagle and files open records requests as well and has a lot of experience there. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you. My name's Jean Hayes. I'm one of the deputy editors at the Wichita Eagle, and a couple of our reporters are in the audience. As journalists, we rely very heavily on the Open Records Act to do our job. Daniel Salazar has been, who's our county reporter, he's been writing a lot about the $500,000 that the county lost to fraud. When he asked the county about that, he was told that it was all an ongoing investigation and they wouldn't talk about it. So he went through the county's open checkbook to find who had a contract for $588,000, and it was Cornejo and Sons, and then filed a series of open records requests, requesting emails between Cornejo and the county, and then requesting the insurance policy and insurance claims, and he was able to get his stories that way. Roxana Hageman with Associated Press wrote a series of stories about Brian Newby, who was one of the top election officials in Johnson County. Her story showed that he was having an affair with a woman that he had promoted, and that they had lavished spending by having her charge expenses to her credit card, which he then approved. The Associated Press went to court to get those emails because the county wouldn't turn them over, and she found all kinds of little love notes that they stupidly wrote on their county accounts saying, "You, my little lover, are so wonderful, and I'm scheming and dreaming with you into the night." Those are kinds of things that you can only get through a Quora, and they're well worth it. Several years ago, Tim Potter, who's one of our crime and safety reporters, through a really creative use of open records, showed that Norman Williams, who was the police chief at the time, was on the Brady Giglio list. That's the list of officers whose testimony could be called into question by defense attorneys because they have something in their past where they've either lied or they've falsified a report or something. When he first asked the city about the rumor that Norman Williams was on that list, they told him they couldn't talk about it because it was a personnel record. We went through three or four gyrations of open records requests that were in part crafted by our attorney to finally get the proof that he was indeed on that list. Open records in Kansas is kind of a mixed bag. We've seen some improvements, but we're still having a lot of problems with it. Among the victories that we've had is affidavits are now open. Kansas is one of the last states to open affidavits. Those are the things that the police file to tell the reason that a person has been charged. The city of Wichita, as Seth mentioned, now has an open data portal where you can look at police calls, you can look at the traffic tickets that have been issued. You can look at, soon we'll be able to look at the summary of complaints against officers. We had a change last year in the state's open records law, which was brought about by one of our reporters, Brian Lowry, who used to be the Eagle State House reporter. He's now with the Star. It resulted from a series of stories he wrote about Sean Sullivan, who was the budget director, had shared some proposals with lobbyists proposing to increase the cigarette tax. He hadn't shared those with the legislators yet, and one of the people he shared those emails with turned out to be a tobacco lobbyist. Sullivan had written those emails on his private email account, which meant that they were outside the reach of CORA. We couldn't get to them. Sullivan said he wasn't trying to skirt state law at the time by using his private email. He was just on holiday break and didn't have access to his email. That would probably make him the only high-ranking official in the state of Kansas or the only person in the state of Kansas that doesn't have access to his home to his work email on his cell phone. So Brian turned around and filed a records request asking for all emails that Sean Sullivan had sent on his work account during that Christmas holiday. State law says that the state has to turn those records over within three, or they have to respond within 3 days. That was written to give them time to get records out of the salt mines. It took the state 7 months to finally turn over the records to us, showing that Sean Sullivan had sent a lot of emails on his work account during that holiday period. Anyway, Brian ended up getting the law changed, and now your emails aren't exempt if they pertain to state business that were sent on your personal account. We had another victory in late 2015. We had done a protracted court fight over the release of records pertaining to a nonprofit in town, Hunter Health Clinic. We spent more than $25,000 in court trying to get those records. And the judge, the ruling that the judge made was one that strengthened the CORA. The judge ruled that CORA is a sword to open records, not a shield to prevent their disclosure. Despite those victories, we still have a lot of problems. The bad news is that there's more than 300 types of records that remain closed in the state of Kansas. Among them are records of private public partnerships, which we seem to be doing more and more of. It's almost impossible to see how the money is spent if the money's being spent by a private corporation or private group that's getting the money from the public. And just as an example there, when Wichita won the NCAA tournament bid a couple of years ago for the 2018 tournament, we filed some CORAs just to find out what the city of Wichita had promised the NCAA that we would do. It wasn't an investigative piece. We just thought it would be fun for people to know, you know, we promised a fan party, we promised hotel rooms at this rate and stuff. Go Wichita, which is one of the private groups that gets public funding, refused our request. WSU ended up granting it, which is how we got the records there. So that's...
Thank you, Jean.
I'll quit.
So obviously we've got a lot of knowledge here on the panel, and we can get them to answer questions that we have. And the we is all of us here. So if you would like to ask a question, there are question slips on the tables. If you find, you know, that there aren't any left there, raise your hand, and Haley here. Haley, raise your hand. Haley will bring you a question slip that you can fill out your question on. When you've filled it out, bring it to her, or she'll come around with a basket that you can drop them in. And go ahead and get to writing, and we'll, in the meantime, we'll get going with our discussion here. And also, if you've come in and don't have a seat, make friends with someone who seems to have a seat available. We're all sharing tonight. So, again, thank you, and let's get going here. Dr. Dooley, I'd like to start with you, if you can kind of give us a little background on these laws, how they came to be, if there's been any evolution since they've been started, and their purposes.
I love history, so you're going to see a little bit of that in my in my presentation. We didn't have a huge government. The way that it spread over the 20th century, government became a huge bureaucracy. And whenever you have a structure like that growing and growing and growing, it gets harder and harder to see what people in the government are doing, to imagine what they're doing even sometimes. So over the 20th century, this growth of government and bureaucratic red tape, and also other factors over the 20th century, the growth of the power of the presidency, the giant media, the fear of communism today, fear of terrorism, and kind of being in a constant state of readiness for war or in some kind of a war. All of these factors, as well as others, just kind of came to a head in the 60s and 70s, as well as into the 80s. It was also part of a consumer movement, the rights of consumers, that kind of plays into this idea that we as the people should have access to the government. You'd think it would have been provided from day one, but it wasn't. In fact, up until the mid-60s, the presumption when it came to government records and meetings was that they were closed. Now, starting in the 60s, the federal government in 1966 passed its open records law, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA is how it's pronounced. That flipped everything on its head. Instead of the presumption being that government records are closed unless somebody petitions for them to be open, the new law put into place this idea that all records are open unless they're exempt by law from being open. And so in 66, we had federal government enact that law. And then we see states across the union, including Kansas, enact similar laws only on the state level. And so in Kansas, we had lawmakers in the 70s and 80s create laws that kind of are very similar to the federal open records and open meetings laws. Kansas is interesting because we have a lot of exemptions in our federal, state open records laws. There are around 50 exemptions. So let's just imagine what an exemption would be. You know, people work for the government, and they have private personnel records. Those kinds of records are exempt from being routinely open, okay, because they're private. It's like a health record, right? You don't want everybody to have access to it. Patents are secret. That's an exempt area. If a government agency wants to sell a piece of property and they don't want everybody in town to know about it, they can keep that information quiet for a time anyway, because up to a certain point, if people know about it, then there's going to be an inflation. There's going to be efforts to try to inflate the price. And if you're selling, that's okay. But if you're buying, that's not okay. So anyway, those are just a few examples of some of the exemptions that that exist in open records laws. So if the record that you want falls into one of those exemption areas, then you might have trouble getting it. Otherwise, the record should be routinely available to you once you ask for them. And then there's a waiting period of supposedly 3 days. Unfortunately, this isn't always what happens. 3 days becomes more, and then some people have some problems with that. But anyway, that's Seth, a little bit about the history.
Yeah, Seth and Jean, can you give a few other examples of records that have been closed? The kinds of things that actually aren't available, maybe that are less expected?
Sure. our problem necessarily isn't records that are closed. The biggest problem that we're having right now is the cost of getting those records are going up to the point where they're almost cost prohibitive. Topeka Capital Journal wrote a story about a year ago that the Department of Children and Families was trying to charge them $2,855 for some records because they wanted the attorneys to review the records before they were released at the charge of $45 an hour.
Charges go to the people requesting the records.
Yeah, no. You have to pay that. I thought I saw Catherine Burgess, who's with the Eagle here. Yeah, there she is over in the corner. We have a records request pending with the Kansas Department of Health and Environment right now for a story that we're trying to do out of the Wichita area. And KDHE is telling us that a conservative estimate is that it'll cost us $3,000 to get the records, and it's probably going to be a lot more than that. And the reason is because they want an attorney to read every single word before it's released to us, and those attorneys are really slow readers. We would pay the charge, except there's the state law allows a deliberative process exemption, which essentially allows the state to hide this decision-making process, which is actually what we're after, is how KDHE made the decisions that they made. So we're afraid if we pay the $3,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 to get the records, they will take out anything that's remotely interesting before we get it, and we would have just wasted our money. Our attorney's telling us that our main recourse would be to sue, but then again, we're looking at $20,000 to $30,000, and we're not sure that that's really going to be worth it. And this is stuff that affects people's health in Wichita, and we think they should make those records public. So far, we're kind of at an impasse with them. Another example of that is there was a guy named Randy Leach from the Leavenworth area who disappeared in 1988. Somebody is trying to get the law enforcement records related to the investigation of his disappearance. KBI is asking for $4,000 for just to get those records. So if you're an individual, these amounts are difficult for news organizations to pay these days, but if you're an individual, it's just cost prohibitive for you to get the records. And it's mainly because they're having attorneys read every word before they release them to you, and then they're taking out anything that's remotely useful.
Seth, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I can add a little bit. For a quick disclaimer, I feel like I'm going to be the one over here trying to cheer on the government while the other two are playing the opposite role. But that's okay. I mean, you know, you need both sides of it. So one of the things that... I'll give an example that's kind of on the other side in support of it. So right now, some of the data that is talked about a lot these days is police data. So their police reports, you know, what actually happened in certain incidents, their decision-making process for rulings, and, you know, the police departments are under fire in this country right now, and, you know, not for bad reason, of course. So that kind of information, of course, is going to be under huge public scrutiny. And again, by the notion of we pay the taxes, so we should be able to see this information, then yeah, it should be available. But that can be a really difficult process because raw data is still subjective in some way. But one of the things that the city has done is they're working on this project called Project Comport. And this is a project that came, it was built by another civic hacking group actually up in Indianapolis. And it publishes police accountability data. So this is something our city is actually trying to do right now, is show, you know, how many complaints against officers were filed, you know, and then all of the information that's surrounding that. It's pretty impressive. So. But you don't often see that in most cities. You don't see them proactively publishing their, especially police accountability data.
Could I add something to that?
Absolutely.
I think he's correct that there are times when availability of records can create a new problem in the era of the internet and computers. Yeah. And big data. For example, there are companies in business to publish on the internet images of people who have been arrested. They may not have been convicted of anything, but they were arrested, and maybe who knows what happens, right? Well, those records are available, and so I'll bet you've heard of people whose faces and the information that they were arrested is on. Online, that's embarrassing. Even if you were completely innocent, that material is out there because of open records. And that is a problem coming out of open records, because those images can mean a young person might not be able to get a job because of that. And if they were never convicted or didn't even go to trial because it was a meaningless arrest or something like that. But, you know, that can cause another problem.
Yeah, absolutely. That's that's part of the process of them reviewing what information actually gets released. So, you know, there is good reason to do that. The problem from a technology perspective, these kinds of processes could be determined and put in place, and then they could stay in place so that the data, you know, this kind of review process doesn't have to happen continually. But that is a thing that we have to decide and be careful about, is what do we publish and what do we not publish? What sort of information should be at least restricted to some degree? Because, yeah, it's really easy for the wrong data to get published online and it completely destroy a person's life because it gets misconstrued. So, yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the reasons a data would be restricted. From what I understand, they fall into these categories of personal privacy, national security, and law enforcement. First of all, is that accurate? And then what are the pros and cons? I want maybe just expand a little bit upon pros and cons of allowing this information to be open to people.
I think that we need to have police records, some police records available, not just because we want to check up on people who have been arrested, but it helps us understand the conduct of police officers. And so that's a positive, in my opinion. Anybody else?
Yeah. There's a lot of potential downsides of publishing, you know, the wrong data or data that's exposing people's personal information. I'm sure none of us in here would like our personal data to be published, right? So, you know, it's completely understandable. Some of the pros, though, are that, you know, when you open this data up, and this is what we try to do at Open Wichita as much as possible, is see. What can we actually use this data for? What data, you know, the information's available, what can we get out of it? You know, what can we, what research can we do to figure out some things from this data? What can we use, what kind of applications and services can we use this data to power? It's finding the balance between those two things. Technology, data, all these things, they're just tools. They can be used for good or bad. So figuring out that balance so that we can maximize the good potential we get from it and minimize the bad is going to be a very difficult and messy process, and it's not anything we're going to figure out anytime soon. But, you know, accepting that and working through it and erring on the side of publishing as other than keeping it in is always going to be the best way forward.
My personal feeling is that almost everything should be open, but obviously we're not going to publish everything. There's good reasons to keep your medical records private, your personnel records private, some security information private. Years ago, I remember you could look online and find schematics of most of the chemical plants and the water treatment plants in the country after 9/11. All that information went away. The information about what kind of risk a chemical storage posed to residents went away after 9/11. That's bad because people don't know what they're living next to, but it's good because it doesn't let terrorists or people who would do harm find the chemicals that easily. I feel like almost we use a little bit too much of the exemptions, though, for personnel and privacy reasons to exempt stuff. So I would try and trust the public to decide what to do with the information and turn it over to them. I would really love to see how much we pay to get a company when they come in for economic development, how much we're paying to subsidize jobs when we try and attract companies here. I would love to be able to find out how much our economic development groups are getting paid and how they spend their money. It's public money, so I think it should be accountable. So.
Thank you. I have a question from the audience here. Should companies be able to make CORA requests and then sell that information? Should they? Are they able to? And should they?
I don't know. I don't know what the law dictates necessarily. Should they be able to? I mean, I guess I don't see a huge amount of harm in it because if the public is educated, they would know that they can go get that data as well. Now, if we're talking about if this is data that's behind some kind of cost prohibition, I think that's a little bit of a different story. If there's equal access to that data, if the company wants to try and sell it while the public can go and still get it free from the government, then, I mean, what harm are they really doing?
Anyone else want to weigh in? Did you want to?
I think every case is a little bit different. The example I gave a little while ago about the records that are of people's arrests, for example, can be very embarrassing to them. On the other hand, I'm sympathetic to that, to them, to their situations. But on the other hand, I don't think we need to restrict very much at all. And those decisions have to be weighed very carefully. I think companies can get information. To my knowledge, it's not against the CORA to buy information, or to get information, rather, not to buy.
Yeah, anybody can file a CORA, an attorney, a company, a person, anyone can file a CORA request. You may not get it filled, but you can file it. There is a provision in the state law that prohibits people from profiting off of the data that they receive under CORA. So you can't file a CORA request and then use that to create your mailing list to sell a product to people. And that's not allowed under current state law.
Another audience question here. How does Wichita rank as far as cities who have metadata, who have made data available, and has the county done the same?
The city, we definitely, we're doing better than you would probably expect. Now, the open data efforts on the part of the city are still pretty, they're still in very early stages. And another thing I always try to, bring up when I'm having these discussions is having sympathy for government, especially local government, because they don't have that much money to work with, and they do have a very big job. So, considering the limited resources that our government has to work with and, the complications of pleasing a lot of people all at once, they've done a pretty good job. We have an open data portal now. The first thing they did was adopt an open data policy. And they didn't just write this policy up themselves. They actually came to Open Wichita and said, hey, we want to do this. Would you work with us on this? So the open data policy that they adopted was based on an open data policy that was adopted by the city of Washington, D.C. So you can see this kind of this municipal open data policy thing is becoming more popular in cities around the country, and they're kind of learning from each other because everybody's learning as they go. This is, we all know technology is advancing much faster than we are. So, they're struggling to adopt these practices, but they're definitely trying. Our open data portal, you can see this at opendata.wichita.gov, and they're constantly adding new data sets. They have regular committee meetings where we're talking about what data should be on there, any problems with existing data sets. So it's a slow and iterative process, but we're getting there. And we're actually working on a couple projects that are powered by this open data as well. So, that's another thing. They're coming to us and saying, what kind of data, here's all the data we have. That was the first step of this open data policy process, was figuring out an inventory. What all data do we collect internally, and then figuring out what do we publish and what do we publish first? What do we prioritize? Because it's going to take some resources to put those processes in place so that data is just available online. City budget data, not just that big PDF book that they produce every year. The raw budget data is available on their portal, so we've been taking that and building it into an interactive visualization. So, these are the kind of things that you can do when the raw data is available.
I think the city of Wichita is adding an open checkbook in early 2018, too, which will really help. It'll make it easier to query. The state of Kansas already has an open checkbook. It's called CanView, K-A-N-V-I-E-W, if you want to look it up. You can see how the state agencies spend their money. It's very helpful. County used to have an open checkbook. They took theirs down. I don't know if they're going to go back up. The county also took down their staff directories. I don't know if they plan to put that back up or not.
So let's say you go to canview.gov.org, CanView?
I can't remember which one it is.
CanView.something.
Yeah. Org or Gov, one of the two.
What was the one that you mentioned? Just Google it. But the one that you mentioned was the city one.
Opendata.wichita.gov.
Yes. And then you can just sort of see possibilities. Like, I could look up this or that. Sorry, guys. You can see, like, lists of data categories, essentially. Uh-huh. Okay, that's interesting. Go there. Check that out. I have a question from the audience. Are minutes of city council executive sessions considered open record?
Yes.
They are?
I believe so. Are they not?
Executive sessions?
Not the executive sessions.
No, we've tried. No. No. My favorite story, I can't remember what town this was in, but it was in a really small town where the city council didn't have a separate chamber to retire to for their executive session, so they made the audience leave. And there was a reporter in the audience who turned on his tape recorder and left it in his suit coat and walked out. And he found that during the executive session, they were discussing a lot of things that they shouldn't be discussing in executive session. I wish we could get minutes of executive sessions. We can. It would be great.
What is the purpose of the executive sessions? I mean, why does that have to be a closed...
Yeah, it's for personnel issues, lawsuits pending against the cities or the government agency. If there's anybody in the audience that remembers the other exceptions, let me know. They can talk about property acquisition, I think, in executive session, some things like that. Before you go to an executive session, you have to state the purpose, and then you have to tell people what time you'll be resuming, and then any public votes are supposed to be taken in the public meeting.
Now, I've had two audience members with this same question. So how can you know or double-check that records you receive are complete? Emails, for example. Is there any way to know?
I haven't figured it out. I have not figured that out yet.
You can't.
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't. You don't know what they're exempting. You don't know what they're hiding. I hate to sound... cynical, but I am, so you can't. Your best defense is just to have somebody within the agency who's willing to talk to you, just to have sources. And you can't just rely on open records to tell you what's going on. You have to have actual people. And sometimes you can get somebody with the city or the county or the state who's just helpful and wants to see the information out there. They'll give you suggestions for what to Quora. They'll give you suggestions for what to ask for. They'll tell you what's going on to some degree to help you build your stories. But Quora is just one tool to use.
In your opinion, should government pay the legal expenses when they lose a Quora case, for example? I think I know what Seth will say.
Yeah.
Is there any way for us as citizens to encourage that to become a reality?
Talk to your legislators. You know, I mean, push them to do these kinds of things. It won't happen otherwise because it's just, there's a lot of inertia. And sometimes it takes years and years for positive change in terms of what the public gets to happen. The idea of how much is charged for copies of documents is something that hasn't moved very fast in the legislature. A few years ago, I worked with a guy he and his wife asked for some school records that they wanted to take a look at, and they didn't realize until they got the bill that it was $800. Well, they went up to the legislature when they worked with somebody to write a bill that would make it clearer how much, make the information clearer about how much was going to be charged if they actually went through with fulfilling the request before you have to pay it. So you can make an informed decision about whether you think the records are something that you really want or not. Well, that bill was not passed, and it's been several years. And so we need people willing to go to their legislators and push them to do these kinds of take these kinds of initiatives. But I don't know. It's up to us, really.
I just want to jump in on that really quickly, just to say one of my favorite moments from a Democracy on Tap event that we had last year occurred during an environmental discussion, and one of the panelists said that she was having a conversation with one of our legislators and said, you know, we're talking about this issue, and the person said, well, if I get two people who email or call or in some way make contact with me about the same issue, then I take some kind of action on it. It was either two or three, I can't remember, but it was like not very many. So just wanted to throw that out there. What were you going to say, Jean?
When we file CORAs, we always put in that if this request is going to exceed $50, please contact us. And that way you won't get like a $3,000 bill at the end of it. And then if they tell you, yeah, it's going to cost you $150, ask them for an itemized account to show you exactly how they're spending the money. And that way you have a chance to argue a little bit upfront about if they're charging you a dollar a page for a copy instead of 25 cents a page, which is more customary. Or if they're having a lawyer review something that a clerk could do, so they're charging you $45 an hour when they could charge you $20 an hour.
Yeah, I've heard people argue that some local governments are, they really want to charge a lot. For the records, it helps pad their budget. Now, whether that's the case or not, I don't know, but there are some states in the union that pay, California, actually has a budget to pay local units of government to fulfill records requests. We don't have anything like that, and the idea seems to be aberrant to the state legislature because they refuse to do anything about the high cost. I'm really glad to hear that the Eagle has that the use of that. You know, ask them to let me know if it's going to be more than $50. The problem is the average person doesn't have that insight into the problem, so they make the request and then they get the bill and they're really hard-pressed to pay it.
Even beyond that, I mean, the average person probably doesn't know how to file a request in the first place. You know, that process in itself is convoluted, so you know, there's several layers to the problem.
The city of Wichita has a form on their site. If you want to file a records request with them, you can fill out the form. And it walks you through what to do. I know some of the state agencies allow you to do file reviews, and they'll have a form on their site, too, to do a file review. Or just call their public information officer and just be really sweet and say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. Can you please help me? If that doesn't work, call the legislature and say, this agency's been really difficult. Can you help me? Some of the legislators sometimes will help you get records, too. Or they can request a legislative audit, then you'll have them too.
That is something that I was going to ask as we got deeper into this, is what the process is to actually go about filing one of those requests. And you can describe that a little bit, that'd be great, unless you just think that would be the better way for people to go, is to just call and have someone kind of walk them through.
On the federal side, there used to be something, and I meant to look up the website before I came, there used to be something called a FOIA tracker, and if you Google it, hopefully you'll get something, but it gave you a form to fill out, and it also gave you the person with the federal agency to direct your request to, so it was a very easy way to file a FOIA request. With the state, we just write a request that says, and Oliver or Catherine can tell you how their requests go. It just usually says something like, you know, I'm a journalist with the Wichita Eagle, or I'm a resident of Wichita, Kansas, and I'm filing this request under the Kansas Open Records Act. Please give me all documents related to, and then be as specific as you can in describing what you want, and then say, you know, if the request is going to be more than $50, please let me know and contact me at this number. Before you file the CORA request, a lot of times it's helpful to call the agency who keeps the records and find out who keeps them, find out what form they keep them in, and that can help you craft your request. Also, both the state of Kansas and the city of Wichita, and probably the county, have something that's called a retention schedule. It's under the state law. These are the records that the state and the city are required to keep. And you can go to that retention schedule and see exactly what they're required to keep and how long, and you can kind of use it to just read through it and see if there's any of those records you'd like to request.
One of the biggest problems that the government officials say they have with requests for records is that the person requesting the record doesn't know enough about the record to ask for it in the way that the government personnel can understand. we just don't know the terminology. So a lot of times there's problems that I know that people have had because of they didn't quite know how to put it in words what they were looking for. So I think I agree that the best way to get your records is just to call the office that you're interested in getting the records from and talk to somebody there. In fact, there's someone in every government agency whose job it is to deal with your questions. Take advantage of them.
If you don't trust them, you can also just research the law. Like, I used to be an environmental reporter, and one of my favorite areas was the Clean Water Act. And I would just research the Clean Water Act, and it says that each state's required to compile a list. It's called a 313 list of all the polluted waters in the state. And so I knew to ask for the 313 list. So you can just go on the web and research the area that you're interested in, find out what records by law they're required to keep, and file for those. We've done a series of stories, Tim Potter did them again, about some business people in the city of Wichita are apparently under federal investigation because there's been some wiretaps going on. And I didn't realize this, but wiretaps are very closely recalled by Congress, and Tim Potter found out that there's the federal courts are required to make a report to Congress every year of all the wiretaps that are done. And by filing for that report, he found out that there's only 5 wiretaps in the state of Kansas last year for gambling, and we know all 5 of those people. We don't know what's happening to them. We don't know where the investigation is, but, you know, that was kind of cool.
Interesting. Maybe this is a good follow-up for you, Jean. Should media agree to hold information until government is ready to disclose?
Oh, no. No. No,
talk about that.
But sorry, I realize that not everybody shares my view because I've been a journalist for too long and I haven't worked in government, and if I worked in government, I'd have a totally different view, I realize. But what we've seen time and time again with the city of Wichita and other, because, you know, I live in Wichita, is a lot of times they don't want to talk about proposals or ideas that are on the table until they're ready to go to the council, and by the time they go to the council, the decision's already made. And I think the public needs to get involved a lot earlier than that while they're still kicking around ideas to say, boy, this is a really stupid idea, or this is a good idea, or what if we did this? But if you wait until government's ready to disclose, they're going to disclose it the day before the vote, if you're lucky. Some days they might only disclose it the morning of the vote. And it's too late for citizens to have an input then, because you can't get your city council person on the phone. You can't research. You can't find out what's going on.
I want to pick up on that. I have a good friend who recently received a letter in the mail. She lives just very close to a piece of property that was going to be discussed in terms of whether it should get the person who wanted to develop the property would get tax credits. And the letter that she received that announced this process that had been underway, there a person had gone out, bought all the property, so he owns it and he wants to develop it for his business purposes and get tax credits for it. She got the letter, no return envelope, no return address. The letter was written by someone unidentifiable in terms of connection to the company that wanted to get the tax credits, and it was about 4 days before the first meeting that was going to be held to discuss the tax credit issue. Well, that doesn't give the people in that neighborhood enough time to consider what's going to be happening and whether or not there's a consensus one way or the other about what should happen in their neighborhood. I get so angry when I hear that public officials say, well, we don't hear from anybody. The public just doesn't care. They're apathetic. Not true. What the public in a lot of cases are is really cynical because they feel like they've been left out of the loop for years and years and only called in to comment on something when it's really too late and the decision has pretty much already been agreed upon. So I think that this is a little bit off the CORA and COMA and open records, but openness in records and the proceedings of government officials make it, if you're not involved in a timely way, you can't really be a participant, and then you become cynical, and that is a bad thing. So I think Americans really care about what happens in their communities. It's just that we're so used to being left out until it's too late that we get apathetic.
One positive that the city of Wichita did a couple of years ago is they started putting out signs on pieces of property that are going to have a zoning change. So you see those signs, they don't give you any, it just says development application. That means there's a zoning change going on and you need to call and find out what it is. But they did that in response to some citizens complaining that they weren't getting any advance notice of what was going on in their neighborhoods. So that was a positive development. I'll give them that.
Here's another audience question. In your opinion, how well does Wichita State do with open records? Dr. Dooley, do you want to start with this one?
Great. I get to talk. Well, at least I'm tenured, right? I'm not going to say that I really can give you an informed answer. Because I haven't made it I haven't pursued a serious study of how they've responded. But I have heard some negatives. So I think there have been a couple of examples in the last few years where they weren't entirely forthcoming with information or access to meetings that they should have been. So, I have to say I'm not extremely informed. Maybe I should be, but. Maybe Jean can answer that.
When Ted Ayers was the general counsel there, he was great. He was very easy to work with, and he always gave us anything that we requested. He's retired, so he can't get in trouble, right? But he was just, he believed in openness, and he was very easy to work with. Since I've had a change in general counsel, we've noticed a definite difference. It's not quite as easy to get records from them. It takes longer, costs more. To go back to the Hunter Health example that I gave you earlier, this was the case where we went to court to get the records. And the reason, it was about a nonprofit, Hunter Health Clinic, and nonprofits aren't subject to CORA, but two of the board members worked for Wichita State University, and they used their Wichita State University email to conduct board business. Really dumb idea, but it made them, in our opinion, subject to CORA, and eventually in the judge's opinion, subject to CORA. So after 2 years and tens of thousands of dollars, we won the case, and you know they were supposed to turn over the records. And we heard that WSU was still going to fight us on it and not give us the records. Hunter Health Clinic decided that they had had enough. They weren't going to protect this executive that they had essentially fired a few years ago, and they gave us the records. But I'm not sure we ever would have gotten the records, or we would have had another fight on our hands to get them from WSU. Mm-hmm. Sorry, WSU. I graduated from there, so I'm sorry.
Interesting. Another audience question here. What efforts have been made to address online data tracking and the sale of your info to, quote, advertisers?
Seems like this is in my wheelhouse.
Yep.
So the issue here is not with government data, unfortunately. The issue here is with the data that's being collected by you by using Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Google and every other online service that you use and are probably going to keep using after tonight. So they know way more about you than any government entity, period, like by a massive scale. And since that's the private sector, right now it's, you know, That's some of the legislation that's still being worked out. We're still kind of trying to figure that out. But right now, it's still pretty much the Wild West. There are a lot of companies who are profiting massively off of your data and figuring you out. So there are a lot of groups out there who are trying to fight back against this and lobby against this. There are some players in the technology space who are working against this too. So, I imagine most people in here probably use the Chrome browser or Internet Explorer. Firefox is actually the company that creates Firefox, Mozilla. They do a lot of research into how to how to deliver all the experience that you are expecting from all of these online services without compromising your privacy and collecting that data. So you know, they've been doing this for several years and still haven't really figured out an exact answer. But if you are concerned about online privacy, that's a much more lengthy discussion. And I know a personal source in this room who knows way more about it than I do. But that's something that we've talked about and we've had a discussion about that within Open Wichita. And there's a lot to know. So if there's if this is something that you're interested in, yeah, definitely come talk to me.
Thank you. Another audience question here. What difference would it make if the government pays for data access and copying costs if it would ultimately be paid in the end by our taxes? Was there any discussion of that? Is that a possibility? What are we doing?
I think it's, it would be nice if they would cover the cost. You know, that would allow the average citizen to file a request and not have to worry about that being something that prohibits them. But at the same time, I think we should go a step further where this, if the data is legally, if you can retrieve the data through a FOIA request or a CORA request, it should just be published. You shouldn't have to go through this process. It should be even more accessible. And then, going down the technical path a little bit more, it should be in machine-readable format so that if we want to process it or analyze it, we can do that. Giving me a PDF of budget data doesn't let me do anything with that information. I can't build anything powered by that. So, yes, that would be a step in the right direction, but I don't think that's, we should be going further than that.
I think there's a chance that if we expect, if some people can't afford to pay what it costs to get the information. I mean, it may seem to me I make a decent living and I can pay for records if I have to. If I had to pay $800, if it was important to me, I could do it. But I'm not below the poverty level, and a lot of people are in this community. So it's a little tough for me to say that it should. That it should be purely pay when you pay, the taxpayer pay, and not, I could make a case that if it came out of our tax dollars, at least it would get to everybody. Mm-hmm. But I also think that if it did all come out of our tax dollars, they would pay a lot of attention to, probably more attention to being careful about not making the order bigger than it should be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, my question a lot of times is, why does it cost $3,000 to produce this data? Why is that the price tag in the first place? It's not a matter of who should be paying for it. If we would invest in better government internal processes, then, that wouldn't be the case. Let's focus on trying to make it cheaper to produce data.
I actually have talked to at least one person who said that when they called a state agency, they were told, yeah, you can have these records if you want us to copy them and send them to you for X number of dollars or so, quite a bit. And then found out later that they're available free on the internet.
Ouch.
Ouch is right.
Yeah, that lesson there is always check the data portal first.
So what cities or states can we look to as bright spots of open government data? Maybe you talked about D.C. a little bit, what you're doing there. Are there other, do we know about other states in the country that are working on this?
To be honest, from a state level, I'm not sure. As far as cities go, D.C. is definitely a good example. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is a very good example. I believe Boston has pretty good practices as far as data goes. I know that they've done some interesting thing actually utilizing data. I'm not sure as far as the open practices. And then, lots of cities out on the West Coast, of course, Portland, San Francisco, they've got some great practices. So they've really invested in having internal teams, making this a government agency of its own. So when you do that, your practices are obviously going to be way better.
There's a network of state organizations nonprofit organizations that work for openness. One of them is called the Kansas Sunshine Coalition for Open Government. It's here in Kansas. They are affiliated with the other state organizations that are looking for openness and promoting openness. And so if you go to Google and start looking around using different search terms, open government organizations, you'll find a whole network of organizations, and they publish regular newsletters, etc., and so you can do a little research. As a matter of fact, I have a handout here. I brought about 30 copies, if anybody wants one, that has a the link written on it for the Kansas Sunshine Coalition. And then also, for the class that I teach, I created a video that is about 13 minutes long that provides a lot of the information that we've been talking about here and some examples of problems that we've had in Kansas and in some problems in other states as well. And so it's on Vimeo, so anybody can see it. So I've got that link on here, too. So after the program, if you want to come up, take a look, you can have one.
That video you said is on the Sunshine Coalition website?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Gene, did you want to weigh in on that? Here's another audience question. What do you say to those who try to control data because the public will politicize it, even use it to threaten public officials, for example? What is your opinion?
Can we clarify what you mean by patrol?
I can't.
Read the question one more time, I'm sorry.
What you would say to those who try to control data because the public will politicize it, or maybe the media will politicize it, or even use it to threaten public officials, thinking we're going to control this data for safety's sake.
I fundamentally disagree with doing things out of fear of something that you're not sure is going to happen in the first place. If all of our decisions are motivated by that, then all data will be closed, and we'll only open it up if we're sure it's going to do some good, and that's not the side we should err on. Will it get politicized? Will it get misused? Yeah, there's a very good likelihood of that. But the thing is, the same people who would misuse that data or politicize it for their own personal ends are going to find some other way to get, to work towards those ends. It's not going to solve the problem. I guess that's what I'm getting to, is that holding the data back doesn't actually solve the problem. So.
I agree. We saw a lot of data disappear after 9/11 for safety's sake, and I don't think that was being politicized. Like, you used to be able to get the schematic for Wolf Creek online, and you can't find it now. So we saw a lot of data disappear after that. The investigative reporters and editors once a year give out something called the Golden Padlock Award, which is state agencies that are being, or federal agencies that are being, particularly difficult in fulfilling records requests. And a lot of times they have a political agenda in doing that. The 2016 award, nominations are open for 2017 if you want to nominate anybody. Just go to the IRE website. They would love to hear from you. But in 2016, the award went to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and because they withheld records about the qualifications of medical staff who evaluated thousands of veterans for potential brain injuries after their service to their country. And their reason for doing so was the information would not contribute to the public's understanding of the federal government. So there was an internal investigation on that, and later on the VA found out that about 25,000 veterans across the country had their brain injuries diagnosed by doctors who were not qualified to make those calls. Is one example.
I think that I'd be really suspicious of anybody in government who absolutely refuse to give out information or records because they're afraid of the backlash, the results. That to me would be a little suspicious. You know what I mean? I wonder what that person has to hide. But here's a quote from James Madison, 1822. He stated, quote, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it, it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. We need, it's our government, not their government.
So I have two fun facts that are a little bit, So sidebar. That quote actually inspired a project that I work on at OpenGov Foundation, which is called Madison, and it's a collaborative legislation drafting platform. It's a tool for government officials to use to get feedback from the public on a legislative document. You know, they have to make the decision to use it, but it's something that we provide. Other fun fact: there's an awards ceremony that IRE puts on that she was just talking about, where they highlight people who are doing a bad job as far as transparency goes. And again, the OpenGov Foundation, the organization I work for, next week we're hosting an event in D.C. called the Doorstop Awards to honor people in Congress who do a good job of transparency. So, you know, we've got things working on both sides, which is good.
Is there anything like that in Kansas or Wichita? A local version?
Not aware of one.
No.
Let's get that started. So I have a question from the audience that I can't read very well, but I'm going to try to get at the idea here. The relation between government and corporations and data that reveals the relationships there, is that kind of data generally available?
It's, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I know that the other two panelists have a much more intimate knowledge of the law itself than I do, but my understanding is that it is supposed to be available, but that's often what you're going to get fought back against the most. And I'm sure you have a lot more to say about that.
Campaign contributions to some degree are public. You can find most of those that'll give you an idea of the relationship between the two. There is a group that does... they track economic development, and they give the amount of public money that's going in to spur economic development. They give Kansas very low scores for our making public the amount of money that's being spent to get economic development and how those economic development dollars are being spent.
Perhaps you're thinking of a situation where a business or corporation is doing work and getting paid with government money, doing work for the government. Normally, you know, the work is done by government workers or personnel, but if that isn't going to happen, they need an expert or they just don't have enough. We contract out some work. We have all kinds of public-private partnerships of that nature in this state. And when records are requested, sometimes there's some real problems because those companies don't necessarily want their information about them made available to the public. So there have been quite a few lawsuits in Kansas. I think you mentioned one of them. I can't remember which one, but there have been all kinds of lawsuits, and it's very unclear how the decisions are going to be made about whether or not the records are going to be available or not.
The more famous ones was actually at the University of Kansas, and I think it was a group of students who were trying to get information from Art Hall about ties to Koch industry and how much Koch industry was funding some of his economic research. And I think the cost was $1,800, and I think they crowdsourced the money, and then they ended up in court to try and get the records. So, I mean, that's one example of what kind of influence do corporations perhaps have.
Jean, can you talk a little bit more about one of the stories that you worked on or that the Eagle produced that really couldn't have happened without open records, maybe from the beginning of the process, one that sticks out the most in your mind?
There's a bunch, but the one I'll go through Tim Potter's story with the police chief who was on the Brady Giglio list. When we initially requested that information, we were told that it was personnel information. A, there's no list. There's got to be a list. There's no list, and then, you know, it's personnel information, so we're not going to tell you. So what Tim Potter did was the police chief retired. So he requested the list of everybody who had Brady Giglio issues by branch of the police department. And he requested that list for the day before the chief retired and the day after the chief retired. So there was like hundreds of people on that, or hundreds of positions on that list. And so we noticed that there was only one person, only one position disappeared, who was on the Brady Giglio list. And so, but they that didn't still prove that it was the police chief. So we went in and we requested the roster. They have to give you the names of the people who work for government. So we requested the roster of all the people who worked in this division prior to the chief's retiring and right after the chief's retiring. And the chief was the only name that was missing. So it was just by power of deduction, it had to be the chief. And that was one that I was kind of amazed we got. Actually, some of the detectives at the police department called Tim Potter and were joking that they should hire him because they were so impressed with what he did.
I want to talk a little bit about different administrations, both on a national level and statewide and local as well. For example, I've heard the Obama administration was infamous for maintaining a fairly opaque records, and so often when a reporter finally received records, a lot of it was blacked out and that sort of thing. Was that a change from what had come before Obama's time, and how will that compare to what we've seen so far with the Trump administration and what you might predict for the future? Dr. Dooley, do you want to kick that one off?
Gee, okay. This is an interesting question. Well, I have to say that I have heard people. I'm not an expert on Obama's record as a provider of records and so on and so forth, except I have read quite a bit of criticism of him in his record for not being open. At the same time, I know that he, right before he was just ready to finish office, he created a document that put more teeth in his administration's response to openness. And I've also heard that since Mr. Trump has been president, that is one of the regulations that has been decommissioned or taken out of effect since Mr. Trump has been president. Now, I have to just say that that is just what, because I'm not an expert on that. That's just what I've heard. I also will say that, you know, the president's office is exempt to some extent, you know, from the reach of, it's the president's office is exempt from having to provide records, as is Congress. So the courts are open by law. But it's surprising, I think, that people don't realize that there are that certain government agencies and the cabinet, for example, are exempt from that.
The Obama administration, I think I read, spent about $37 million their final year in office trying to fight open records requests and just legal fees. So that was kind of surprising. I can't really contrast Trump with Obama. I just know before Trump took office, there was a huge push on the part of journalists and a lot of nonprofits to try and download as much data as they could because they were afraid it was going to disappear from the websites.
One of the things that Obama did do very well was establish better open data practices within the federal government. Now, as far as fighting specific FOIA requests, it's not something I have a whole lot of knowledge about. As we're hearing here, it seems like the consensus is that he fought back against them quite a bit. So, but as far as proactively publishing government machine-readable data, he advanced our federal government's practices of that pretty significantly. And what Gene was just mentioning about journalists and scientists and technologists trying to download as much government data as possible before the Trump administration, a lot of that data that was getting published, which a lot of this data is scientific data, weather data over time and being able to track climate change. And, there is a massive amount of scientific studies that exist that are publicly funded. And so the results of those studies should be publicly available. And that kind of information is getting pulled away. There's actually a group called Data Refuge that formed specifically to host events around the country where people could download this data in bulk and make sure that all of it is backed up. On March 5th, on Open Data Day, that was that was one of the things that we encouraged with an event that we hosted here, was for people to try and participate in that. So, from the perspective of proactively publishing government-collected data, especially scientific data, we're going backwards in a very scary way.
What about at the state level? Do we have trends that we've seen over the course of the last few governors, or...
What we've seen with the Brownback administration is it takes them a lot longer to answer records requests. And I think I said before, the law says 3 days, and the Brownback administration has taken that to mean that they just have to respond in some way within 3 days. So normally within 3 days, you'll get a note saying, "We got your request, we'll let you know." And then it could be months later before they'll actually fork over the data, if they ever do. I've noticed a real change. I think almost in some ways information has gotten harder to get with computers. That's how old I am, because it used to be you could just go down to an agency's office and you could look through their file cabinet and find what you wanted. Now it's all locked up in emails. They don't want to give it to you. It costs a fortune to get it out. So in many ways, it's harder to get the data, where it actually should be easier now to get the information than it was.
What you're saying is reminding me of something I thought of earlier while you were talking about the salt mines, or the salts. Where is it that the physical
salt mines? Yeah.
Yeah. So can you talk about that? What the physical documents are stored there, or?
The law says 3 days, and the reason for the 3 days was to give people a chance to get the documents out of the salt mines, because that's how long it would take you to go and get them. I go to the Epic Center every day, where a lot of the federal agencies are located, and I always see the Hutchinson Salt Mine truck out there. They're gathering up the records to take them back and store them underground, because it's dry, it's safe.
So it's safe and dry underground, so they're storing records there, but presumably they have not digitized the records, that they're just burying them, kind of, literally?
Not the old stuff, no.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So what can citizens do with data, open records, to help improve their communities? What are some things that projects you're working on, Seth, or just some ideas for people they'd like to putter around and check out what's available?
Definitely. At the end of the day, it just comes down to being more informed. If you want to be an engaged citizen, you need to be informed, and the only way you get informed is by having information available. A lot of the data that that Open Wichita is talking about is machine-readable raw data, and it can be tedious to go through. It's not pretty. It's not formatted in a way that's easy to understand, but that's what we want. We want the raw data. We don't want the version of it that's doctored up. So, what we want to do then is take that raw data and turn it into something that citizens can use and get some benefits from. And some of this is even just, taking information and making it more accessible. So the budget data is a perfect example of that. We're creating an interactive visualization of the budget data. So you can look at their budget PDF. We just offer an alternative way to interact with that data and see the line items one by one. And then if you want to drill down even further, you can go to the city's open data portal and look through the actual raw data that's powering it. Another thing that people don't often consider data is, the dates and times of meetings. One of the problems is, even if the information is available online or it's available somewhere, it's not easy to get to, and it's something that should be easy to get to, especially public meetings. So we realize there are a very, very large number of different public meetings that happen locally that are anything from district advisory board, city council meetings, education board, everything in between. And finding the information about where those meetings happen is completely possible online, but it's all in different places. Some of them you have to subscribe to an email newsletter to receive the, where the location is going to be, and maybe times change. So we're trying to create a project that will aggregate all of those sources of data into one database and then be able to display it on a website. So that's an example of a couple of the projects we're working on. Another one is the police accountability data. That's a project that came out of another civic hacking group in Indianapolis. The city expressed interest to us about implementing it here. So this is going to take data that right now is not open, but then plugging it into the system that'll visualize it and make it easier to understand. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's just about being informed, and the only way you're going to be informed is if the information's there in the first place, and then also if the information is easier to digest. So,
I like to play with CanView, which is the state's open checkbook. I find it's kind of fun just to go and see how the government's spending its money. All the agencies have information there. You can go and look at the restaurant inspection reports of the Department of Agriculture. You can go to the State Board of Education, and you can look up data on each and every school, individual schools and school districts in the state of Kansas. You can find out how many students are getting in trouble for misbehaving in class in a violent manner. You can go to EPA. You can look at the air quality for the city of Wichita. You can look at the drinking water violations that the city of Wichita or other cities have. You can look at all the polluted sites that are around here. I mean, almost every agency that the state and the federal government has collects data and keeps it. And just poke around on the website and see what you can find. Or call them up and talk to them and see what they'll tell you.
Is there anything else that you all would like to add for people to just kind of be aware of where it comes to open records and open data is concerned? Or something maybe that is fascinating that no one asked about?
I'll just say, you know, Open Wichita is a completely open community group. You know, we are primarily a group of technologists, but we're open to anybody. So if this kind of stuff, open data and what can be done with it and the potential applications of it is something that's interesting to you, you know, definitely talk to us, get involved.
And that's a good question. I was going to also ask if the Sunshine Coalition, is that open to anyone? You can just...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think I'd just like to add that I think a lot of times it's hard to imagine what we might ask for. A particular need will come up all of a sudden that we need the information, but on a day-to-day level, most of us don't think much about it. But at the same time, just think of all the things that the government does. The government is absolutely, every single day, affecting the quality of life in our communities. And so it's not like a different sphere. It is our community. We are part of it. They are us. And so I think we just need to give ourselves permission to be in charge. And I think that over the last generation, we have created this society of experts, and government people are now experts, and the citizens have been cut out by and large. That's why we have something today called citizen journalism and citizen this and citizen that. There's just all kinds of people around trying to make it easier for the average person to be where they should be in the system instead of feeling outside the system.
All right, thank you. Let's have a big round of applause for our panel tonight. Thank you so much. That was a really interesting discussion. Please join us for our next Engage ICT Democracy on Tap event, which will be June 13th, and it will be at Roxy's downtown. Come to that one. We're planning to have a little how-to run for office. So that'll be a really interesting talk. Whether or not you plan to ever run for office, it'll just be very interesting to kind of learn about the process and different considerations there. So join us for that, as well as other Engage ICT Democracy on Tap events throughout the year. We're delighted to have you each month. Thank you again. And our panel will be hanging out with us here for a few more minutes, and you can come up and chat with them, ask other questions, and talk to them about all of this wonderful stuff. Thank you again, and have a great evening.
Thanks for joining us for Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Find more podcasts and videos at engageict.org. This show was hosted at the Monarch in Wichita, Kansas. Our engineers are John Cyphers and Torin Anderson, and I'm the host. For KMUW, I'm Sarah Jane Crespo.